This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring pressing public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine seeks to highlight the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. We do this by introducing you to the efforts of key government executives, the work of public management practitioners, and the insights of leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of these public management issues we face today. We are in the midst of an exciting, engaging, yet trying period, marked by uncertainty, significant challenges, undeniable opportunities, and indelible aspirations. It's about sharing knowledge and expertise gained from the research we fund and the conversations we commence. We hope to spark the imagination of government leaders to look beyond their day-to-day urgencies and reflect on the serious problems and critical challenges they face today into tomorrow. First up, conversations with leaders, featuring dedicated public servants from a wide variety of disciplines who share their extended reflections on the work they do and the efforts they lead. Advances in biomedical research seek to enhance health and length of life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, plays a significant role in making this happen. U.S. life expectancy has increased dramatically over the past century. Not only are people living longer, they're living healthier lives. However, as Dr. Francis Collins, director of NIH, notes, science is not a 100-yard dash. It's a marathon run by a relay team that includes researchers, patients, industry experts, lawmakers, and the public. Dr. Collins outlines how basic research prompted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases, and what NIH is doing to advance biomedical research.
NIH spends about 53% of its budget on basic research, and that would be defined as research on some aspect of biological processes that does not have an immediate implication or application to a disease. But you have to understand how life works at the most fundamental level before you can really understand what disease is all about. So this is the foundation of everything we do. And over the course of many decades, the basic science research, which has led to no less than 135 Nobel Prizes for NIH-funded grantees, is the way in which we've often then gotten to the next level of understanding about a biological process, and that in turn has led to insights about disease, which are now making big differences clinically. If we want to continue to see those medical advances going forward 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to be doing the basic science now that is going to provide that foundation.
This foundation illustrates that basic discovery and the development of therapies go hand in hand. It's about understanding the genesis of disease at the fundamental level. Dr. Collins continues.
Basic science, trying to understand at the fundamental level, what are the causes of various rare diseases? Rare diseases collectively affect about 26 million Americans, and there are about 7,000 of these rare diseases. In the space of just the last 10 years, we've uncovered, using basic science strategies, the molecular basis of about 4,700 of those diseases. Just breathtaking, the rate at which this insight has been coming forward. Of course, that's useful in terms of getting a grasp on what the diseases are all about, but what you really want is to translate that into an intervention. Only about 250 of those diseases currently have any treatment at all.
In the end, it's about turning discovery into action, which, though necessary, is quite risky. Here's Dr. Collins.
By having now made those basic discoveries, we're poised to be able to translate that into action. And that is, in fact, a major focus of a new center at NIH, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. There are a number of steps that you want to follow once you understand the molecular basis of a disease. They're complicated, they're failure-prone, they're risky. But we know increasingly how to do that. And that's a great example of how, at the present time, the basic science informs the translation. I should say, this is also a virtuous circle, that when you make an observation at the basic level that leads you to clinical insight, sometimes when you try this out clinically, you learn something about the basics as well, and you go around that virtuous circle to your benefit over and over again.
How does the new National Center for Advancing Translational Science work to make all this a reality? Dr. Collins elaborates.
So NCATS, this National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, was very much founded on the need to try to identify what are those systematic bottlenecks that cause this process to be so challenging. And it is. The average time it takes to go from a good idea about a new treatment to getting that drug approved is 14 years. The failure rate is well over 99%. Now, an engineer looking at a pipeline like that would say, come on, there must be something better you could do here to improve success and shorten the time. And that's what NCATS aims to do, to look systematically in a way that no single project focus would achieve. Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the things where we lose momentum, where time goes by more than it should, where failure rates are way too high? Could we take some of the new science that's coming forward in the last few years and really re-engineer that pipeline? That's what we're trying to do.
Today, technological advances are driving science. We need to look no further than the cost of DNA sequencing to see this dynamic at work. The cost curve for sequencing is dropping at a breathtaking rate. Sequencing speed has increased even faster than computer processing speed. Dr. Collins elaborates on the implication of this trend.
If you want to pick an area of technology that just takes your breath away in terms of the speed of its progress, it would be DNA sequencing. That first human genome sequence that I had the privilege of overseeing, the team that managed to pull this off, cost about $400 million when it was completed in 2003. You can now get your human genome sequenced for about $7,000. Think about that, 400 million down to 7,000 in the space of just about 9 years, and the cost continues to plummet. So we will, in the next 3 to 4 years, certainly achieve this goal that many people thought was a bit overly audacious, namely the $1,000 genome, but we're well on the way to achieving that. How will that change things? Well, it already is changing things in cancer, increasingly as part of research studies. And it won't be long before this finds its way into the management of cancer in general, is the desire to know in any given individual's cancer exactly what has gone wrong in those cancer cells that's causing them to grow faster than they're supposed to. Because cancer is a disease of the genome. And now we have the chance to look comprehensively, each individual at a time, in what's gone wrong there and what you might want to do about it. Because knowing that, you can then choose the right combination of targeted therapies that are not one size fits all, but are designed for that person's specific molecular signature. That's just one example. Certainly, all of us in the next decade will probably have the chance to have our complete genome sequences placed into our medical record. That will give insights into what you might be at risk for in the future. It will give insights into, if you fall ill, what drug should be used for you and what dose, because individual differences can be predicted by a study of the DNA. So it is going to transform the way we approach many medical problems, but not overnight. There were some overly optimistic predictions that this was going to happen in the blink of an eye. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of research, a lot of driving the cost down to make those things come true.
Why is the work that NIH does so important? Here's Dr. Francis Collins.
I would say there has never been a better time in all of history than right now to come and join this enterprise. We are unraveling mysteries that have puzzled us for all of human history. We're poised to take that information to the next level in terms of preventing and treating disease. We have the chance to bring the basic and the clinical aspects of research together in a very tight connection and a virtuous circle. This would be the moment if you're in any way inclined to get involved in a great detective story that has great answers, come and join the biomedical research team. We've got stuff for you to do.
Since its inception, the country's credit union system has expanded and grown to serve over 93 million Americans. The severe economic crisis impacted all facets of the financial sector, including credit unions. In fact, over 2.5 years ago, the credit union system teetered on the brink of collapse. Debbie Matz, chairman of the National Credit Union Administration, tells us about her agency's history and mission.
The Federal Credit Union Act of 1934 established federal credit unions. The National Credit Union Bureau was established at the time, and it was moved from agency to agency until 1970, when it was established as the National Credit Union Administration as an independent federal regulatory agency. NCUA charters credit unions. We regulate them, we supervise them, and we insure the deposits in federally insured credit unions up to $250,000 per account. So we really are to credit unions what FDIC is to banks.
Matz outlines the size and scope of the work her agency does and how its governance is structured.
NCUA oversees an industry that has $1 trillion in assets, and 93 million Americans have accounts at credit unions. We have a staff of about 1,200 employees, most of whom are examiners. That means that they go into credit unions on a day-to-day basis and make sure they're in regulatory compliance. And they work out of our regional offices. We have 5 regional offices. In Albany, New York, Alexandria, Virginia, Atlanta, Georgia, Tempe, Arizona, and Austin, Texas. And our central office is also in Alexandria, Virginia. In addition to the 5 regional offices, we have 13 major staff offices, which each have a director that either reports to the board or to the top career employee, who is our executive director. Credit unions pay 1% of their deposits, and that establishes the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. And that's the fund that guarantees the deposits up to $250,000. And there's currently $11 billion in the Share Insurance Fund. NCUA has a 3-member board. Mm-hmm. All the board members are Senate confirmed, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate for 6-year terms. The chairman is generally of the same party as the president, and the board sets the policy and the direction for the staff offices.
What does the future hold for credit unions? Once again, Chairman Debbie Matz.
Well, that's something that I talk to credit unions about in just about every speech that I give. I remind them that if they want to be around in 10 years, they need to attract younger members. And in order to attract younger members, they need to provide the services and the tools that younger members need and desire. So, for instance, they need to make sure that they're embracing technology. They need to reach out to young people and get them to understand that credit unions are a good value, because generally in a marketplace, credit unions charge less interest on loans and pay higher interest on accounts. And so that's an important message for young people to know. I always encourage credit unions to reach out to young people in every way that they can, because that's their future.
Good government, that is, government fiscally responsible to its people, has as its charge making operations more responsive, efficient, and accountable, getting rid of waste and saving money. In an era of tight budgets, this charge has taken on significance beyond the fundamentals to encompass the government-wide improvement of financial management. Danny Warfel, controller of the Office of Federal Financial Management within OMB, highlights the top federal financial management priorities.
It's either about cutting waste or it's about building a government for the 21st century. We have this initiative we call the Campaign to Cut Waste. It was launched by the president through an executive order, put the vice president in charge of it. We have a whole variety of different things we're trying to achieve under the Campaign to Cut Waste. We are cutting administrative savings, things like IT, printing, and travel, vehicles or fleet. You know, this is kind of the bread and butter stuff that won't necessarily, you know, eliminate our deficit by any stretch, but represent two things. First, they represent, you know, every dollar counts, and these are practical things that can be done. We don't have to get rid of an automobile. That's fine just because we're interested in the next upgrade. We can hold on to our vehicles longer. You know, we don't need a printer on every desk. We don't need to travel just for the sake of travel without a critical purpose for that travel. We issued that 20% cut requirement back in November of 2011, and then we put in the president's budget all the agency's commitments on that 20% cut, and it totaled $8 billion. And then within the Campaign to Cut Waste, there's other things. There's improper payments. There's managing our real estate more effectively. And I'd say on the 21st century government, there's a lot going on, but to pick a top priority, I'd pick how are we going to move forward in open government and transparency. And in particular, where I have the most responsibility and where I lose the most sleep at night is how are we making federal spending more transparent? All of those things are part of a strategic set of priorities that I'm working on with the financial management community.
The federal government disperses trillions of dollars in payments every year. Unfortunately, there are instances where the government makes payments that are improper. Addressing improper payments is a central component of the administration's efforts to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. Here's Danny Warfel.
We pay a lot of money out. We pay benefits to individuals. We pay contractors. We reimburse doctors for Medicare bills, grants to states, all different variations of payments. We guarantee loans, et cetera. And we make mistakes. The money goes in the wrong amount. It can go to the wrong individual. It could go in the right amount to the right individual, but then be used for the wrong purpose. And so these are the types of mistakes. The more typical improper payment occurs when we lack the ability to validate whether the payment is right or not. The largest sources of error in the government are in Medicare and Medicaid. They make up half our balance sheet. And there's a whole different, you know, it's very complex terrain in terms of how we can make different types of errors in Medicare. Sometimes the issues can be really, really challenging to authenticate. But within all of this, what we've tried to do is find the errors where we have the best chance of initiating changes to improve. And there are some promising areas where we are leveraging data and technology and innovations in ways to drive down these errors, and I'm very excited about that.
Looking forward, thinking about the road ahead, Danny Warfel continues about the future of federal financial management.
Well, I think the number one challenge that everyone, and I think if no matter who you had sitting in this chair, if you have a government leader, they're likely to answer this question, you know, people. And human resources or human capital. You know, we have a lot of individuals in the federal government that are eligible to retire. So there's some succession planning and recruitment. And then also the challenges are changing and the skill sets change with them. Much more specifically in the financial management community, analytics are becoming more important as we figure out how to put kind of traditional accounting functions on a more stable platform. It enables us to shift into more analysis rather than blocking and tackling and nuts and bolts accounting, which is a great thing to be able to do. But you have to have the right skill sets in order to drive those analytics. And it was everything we talked about today in terms of executing on a set of results to cut waste or to bring government in the 21st century. The road to get there is clearer and ultimately shorter if you are driving strategic decisions about what you're investing in, what your critical path is. And those strategic decisions are based on analysis. They're based on looking at data, at looking at our organization, at looking at our business processes, and figuring out what the right navigation points going forward are to be successful.
We'll continue with our conversation with leaders when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies and open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs may be the second largest federal agency, but it runs the largest medical system in the United States, providing care to 6 million veterans and their families who depend on it. This is no small feat considering the demands placed on the system. To meet these demands head-on involves leveraging innovation and advances in technology. Dr. Peter Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer at VA, explains his role and mission to identify new technologies and promote innovation.
I get to ask the hard questions. I get to ask the risky questions. I get to fail, right, in ways that sometimes other folks wouldn't feel comfortable with or, frankly, wouldn't feel empowered. So the first thing that I do, there's a sign on my door. It says, all people who need empowerment, find it here. The first answer out of my mouth is yes. And then we figure out how to get what it is that folks are asking for. This is a direct instruction from Secretary Shinseki. In literally my first day on the job, he pulls all the new political guys, especially the guys he didn't know well. We were new to him at that time. And he says, look, here's the deal. I'm the only guy in the administration who can say no. I'm the only guy in the agency who can say no, right? So your job is to say yes. And that's, I tell you, that's a mission I take pretty seriously. So the CTO role is about exploring the boundaries of new technology. It's about exploring the boundaries of new problems, problems that some folks say, well, you just have to live with that. You just have to suffer underneath it, or you just have to kind of ignore it and hope it goes away. And I get to say, well, geez, why is it that we don't have automated claim system? Why is it that veterans can't get their electronic medical records? Why is it that we don't have suicide prevention chat line for the folks that don't feel comfortable or don't want to call the agency? And then we can start walking through those questions. That's about half of my job. The other half of my job is serving, I would say, as a traditional senior advisor role, confidential actions, personnel issues, making sure that the boss is well prepped for whatever meeting that he has.
Here's Dr. Peter Levin outlining his approach to identifying technology and innovation.
So the way that I approach this, at least, is when somebody brings me a new opportunity, when somebody brings me a problem, I try to fit it into a framework, right? I try to say, okay, so is this a device issue which becomes a hardware issue, which becomes a qualification issue? Or is this a data liquidity issue, which becomes an access issue, which becomes a quality of service issue, right? And I can sort of walk you through maybe 6 or 7 of those opportunities where I have this framework that I've been able to assemble and accumulate over, gosh, you know, 30 years now, right? The next thing I like to do is I like to feed it back. I can map practically any problem you throw at me somewhere in that framework and connect it to things that either that I know that are going on already at the VA or that I know that are going on in the private sector. It's been a huge benefit to me, and I'd like to think that it's been one of the secrets, one of the ways that we've been able to move the ball forward a little bit.
Levin explains how he has sought to enhance the delivery of VA's mental health services.
This is a project that was actually spearheaded by Jan Kemp and by Sonia Batten, two people who I consider sort of my closest collaborators at VA. Now, suicide, as you might know, is an endemic problem in the United States right now, right? It's not particular to veterans. But when veterans have this problem, it's something that we can do something about as long as they're in our system, as long as we can touch them, as we know who they are, they have to identify themselves. Jan had this idea to create a chat service. And she said, well, look, we have this capability. The technology is there. It's not very expensive and it's highly secure. But she was being blocked, you know, by the bureaucracy and by the qualifications and the certifications. So the first project that I worked on, literally in the first month, I can tell you the day that we went live. It was July 3rd, 2009. And we turned on that internet chat service. And fast forward to today, we have over 6,000 interventions, right? Now, that's, I'm not talking about just the chats that we have every time somebody, you know, misdialed us or, you know, they weren't, let me say, weren't looking for suicide prevention services. They were looking for something else. But nothing is more important to me than those couple of folks that are with their families today because of what Jan did a couple of years ago and where I got to kind of help push it across the goal line a little bit.
Dr. Peter L. Levin is a serious proponent of VA using open source technology to meet its mission.
I'll tell you why we do open source, because we're more secure and because it's cheaper in the long run. Okay, now what does that actually, how does that translate into what we're doing at the VA? It translates in a lot of ways, mostly in the area of electronic health records, right? The claims processing piece, it ends up, it seems surprising. You can always use open source components. You can use open source front ends. You can use open source operating systems. There are all kinds of places where it finds purchase there.
It is critical to the safety and security of this country that federal, state, local, private sector, and international partners improve their sharing of information about terrorism, homeland security, and weapons of mass destruction. When examining the full scope of information sharing and protection, many widespread and complex challenges must be addressed and solved by multiple agencies and organizations working together. Smedra Paul, Program Manager of the Information Sharing Environment, describes for us the ISE.
The ISE is a complicated topic. The way I think about it is that the ISE is a collection of normalized mission and technical capabilities distributed and decentralized across all of our mission partners, federal, state, local, tribal, and private sector entities. The ISE is delivered by interconnecting existing networks, systems, and databases, working with industry and standards bodies to adopt required standards and other frameworks. The ISE harmonizes and standardizes information processes based on shared mission equities. And finally, the ISE strengthens information safeguardings, including protecting privacy, civil liberties, and civil rights of the American people. A practical way of thinking about the ISE is to think of it as an information analog to the interstate highway system. The same way the interstate highway system knit together this country post-World War II, the ISE is intended to be the information fabric enabling whole-of-government responses to national security and public safety challenges that face our nation.
Smedra Paul outlines the history and evolving mission of his office.
My office is a core part of the government's response post 9/11. From our inception, our office has had a particular focus in two areas. First, the domestic information sharing architecture, really the nexus between public safety and national security, what some in the law enforcement community talk about in terms of the nexus between homeland security and hometown security. Second, our office has had a focus on identifying, integrating, and disseminating best practices around responsible information sharing, management, and integration, really a direct line from the government reform efforts around information resources management that were anticipated with legislation like Clinger-Cohen, the eGov Act of 2002, FISMA, the Privacy Act, and other related legislation.
In meeting his mission, Smedra Paul faces significant challenges.
The number one issue is 11 years post 9/11, retaining the urgency and prioritization of accelerating responsible information sharing. That's the our number one challenge. We've had a lot of progress. We've made progress. Last year, at the 10-year anniversary, commentators inside, outside the government, all recognized the progress we've made on information sharing post 9/11. But there's more work to do, and it requires focus and prioritization. The number two challenge is new, and it's just as big as the structural financial challenge faced by agencies in the public sector. It's bad at the federal level. It's much worse at the state and local level. Number three is the evolving and increasingly integrated threats that span national security and public safety missions. And four is the tsunami of information and the imperative to correlate disparate bits of information across the distributed ISE. There's lots of data.
Setting standards are critical to the ISE. Smedra Paul also underscores that pursuing standards hardly limits or defeats innovation. In fact, they're complementary.
We absolutely believe that standards enable innovation. You know, the key here is let's innovate where we should innovate. Let's innovate where we can add value. and let's standardize where we have defined requirements and have common mission equities, and we really need to share information. So our standards framework is really focused on exchange standards. It's standards on the edges of organizations, and it's really trying to solve the problem of moving from point to point. So standards are critical to empowering the ISE, and we think the nexus with the standards work is work with industry and standards organizations.
You are listening to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, highlighting the fall-winter 2012, the Business of Government magazine. Next up, profiles in leadership. I've interviewed a variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. In this edition, we introduce you to three leaders who are changing the way government does business. They are indeed profiles in leadership, and here's a glimpse. Richard Boley directs the Office of E-Diplomacy within the U.S. Department of State, and he's charged with making e-diplomacy the way to collaborate within the department.
So really, the nub of e-diplomacy is to make sure that if somebody has the information that another person needs to get their work done, that they can find each other. It's not this hierarchical command and control knowledge management approach where there's some gigantic data basement somewhere where everything needs to be thrown and you go fishing for the information there. It's more that information is where it is, and you just need it to make it discoverable. To facilitate access to the information that a diplomat or our State Department employees need anytime, anywhere on any of our available platforms. And so that's kind of the real nub of it. But part of it is, although I don't like the idea of cultural change, there is a change implicit in this. If we move from a Cold War need-to-know approach where the idea, the watchword was keep information locked down, siloed, because the big bad Soviet bear was out there trying to get pieces and aggregate them to figure out our secrets. And you fast forward to the post-9/11 era where we found ourselves crippled by our inability to aggregate those same pieces of information to identify our threats and vulnerabilities. So that sea change, that change from need to know to need to share, is fundamental to what we do. Equally fundamental is the idea that success is not dependent on the information you hoard, but the ability to articulate the information you have across an important, valuable network throughout the enterprise, not just to the people you know, but people who may be a degree or two of separation away from you, but would benefit from having access to the information you have.
According to Richard Boley, it's about identifying better ways to find and share information and to network, thus enabling and encouraging State Department personnel to securely and effectively contribute knowledge anywhere at any time.
Out of that was born e-diplomacy, which was an effort to put end users in the IT decision-making process and help us develop platforms for collaboration and information sharing really from the grassroots.
The department's ability to maintain institutional knowledge has always been a challenge, given that foreign service assignments typically last 2 years. This makes it even more critical to maintain institutional memory, foster collaboration, and cultivate connections within the department.
Every time that we make a gain, how can we institutionalize that gain so that it doesn't become, the barnacle that gets scraped off the ship when some new leadership comes in, but it becomes woven into the very fabric of how we do diplomacy. Again, getting back to solving problems, we find that that's the best way to institutionalize something. When somebody finds that something, a platform that we've developed, helps them get their job done better, faster, quicker, and more efficiently, they become the advocates for the work that we're doing. And so we really try to have as many people come to that aha moment and move over the hump that always happens when you move to something new.
The importance of harnessing technology and maturing it according to the needs of those it serves cannot be overstated.
And we always say it's not about the technology. The technology is, it should never be the focus. The focus should be what is the end user trying to achieve, and can we achieve it faster, easier, better through the right tool for the right challenge.
We'll continue with the Business of Government magazine when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. For federal agencies to be successful in their continued pursuit of government-wide initiatives, such as reforming federal IT, using new technologies to improve government operations and citizen engagement, and enhancing customer experiences across government, they require support and assistance. Kathy Conrad, Principal Deputy Associate Administrator within the Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies at GSA, explains the dual mission of her office, which has positioned itself as the government-wide leader in identifying and fostering the adoption of innovative technologies and open government.
So our role today reflects both where we've come from, our legacy of serving the public, and our role today as an engine of innovation to help agencies across government meet rapidly changing needs. We have a pretty interesting history spanning over 40 years, which most people aren't aware of. Our roots were planted way back in 1970 with the establishment of the Consumer Information Center, which provided the public with a central source of government information. It's evolved over the years, and in 2002 became the Federal Citizen Information Center, or FCIC, when GSA created the Office of Citizen Services and Communications. At that time, GSA combined the center's 30-year legacy of serving the public with the innovative approach of what was then called FirstGov, which used the rapidly growing power of the Internet to serve as the first sort of single front door to the government. And then more recently, in 2010, the Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technology was created, returning GSA's internal communications back to its own office and adding the Office of Innovative Technology to expand our role in leveraging new technology to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of government. So today we have a dual mission. Mm-hmm. We deliver world-class experience to the public when accessing government information and services anywhere, anytime, through whatever channel they choose, building on our long legacy, and then developing solutions and services federal agencies can easily adopt that will enhance their ability to innovate, deliver services, engage the public, and save valuable resources.
GSA provides agencies with practical tools, models, and proven practices that can improve the efficiency and effectiveness of government operations while enhancing citizen engagement. Kathy Conrad elaborates.
Well, we have a very lean but incredibly productive office, about 100 super talented, hardworking people, plus a team of excellent contractors and a budget of about $35 million, pretty small. But we're a little spark plug igniting innovation all across government through two primary organizations, the Office of Citizen Services and the Office of Innovative Technologies. The Office of Citizen Services provides consumer information and services to the public wherever, whenever, and using whatever device or communication channel they choose. The Office of Innovative Technology identifies and fosters innovative technologies that help agencies increase efficiency, enhance effectiveness of services to citizens, and achieve cost savings. So most of our programs are divided into those two offices. We've got, as I said, the Federal Citizen Information Center, which runs USA.gov, Gobierno.gov, Kids.gov, the National Contact Center, and PublicationsUSA.gov. We have the Center for Excellence in Digital Government, which runs our Challenges program, which you're familiar with, mm-hmm. and supports the Federal Web Managers Council. We have a mobile PMO, which has more recently been combined with our Digital Services Innovation Center. And then in the innovative technology arena, we have the Federal Cloud Computing PMO, our FedRAMP program, Federal Data Center Consolidation Program, and data.gov, along with a few others.
To deliver its mission, Kathy Conrad outlines three strategic goals.
So to deliver our mission, we have three key strategic goals. Innovation, which we define as expand and enhance public engagement with government using innovative, cost-effective solutions and practices that can be adapted and adopted government-wide. Second, customer intimacy, as I mentioned. And there we want to deliver best-in-class customer experience that is driven by results and that other agencies can use. And finally, operational excellence. develop, implement, and accelerate adoption of new technology platforms and initiatives that can improve operational efficiency and effectiveness across government. We seek to foster federal leadership in implementing solutions that are faster, cheaper, and more sustainable.
GSA's Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies also accelerates and incubates government-wide social media and public engagement solutions that focus on transparency, accountability, and citizen engagement, highlighted by such initiatives as data.gov and challenge.gov. But Kathy Conrad acknowledges that innovative ideas and programs cannot come to life in a vacuum.
Partnership and teamwork are at the core of all of our operations. We depend on broad input from the stakeholders we support through established channels like the CIO Council, the Web Managers Council, the Government Contact Center Council, the communities that we've helped establish, as well as through citizen engagement. You know, one of the advantages of using social media and of open government in general is that there are tools that we use to get direct feedback from our customers. And so we consider ourselves working in partnership not just with the agencies, but also with citizens so that we can understand what really is working, what do they really need, and how do we do our jobs better.
Bernard Malekian, director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, COPS, within the U.S. Department of Justice, completes our profiles in leadership by detailing his efforts to advance public safety through community policing. Malekian leads the federal program, which began in the 1990s, and focuses on weaving community policing practices into the fabric of the country's law enforcement community.
Community policing, and the COPS office definition, and certainly one that I adopt, is that it's designed around building relationships, building partnerships, number one. Number two, solving problems. Partnerships between law enforcement and the community it serves to address specific neighborhood issues. And thirdly, is an organizational transformation within the law enforcement agency. At some point, and I think this is, I think this has been the sticking point, at some point, community policing has to become, cease to be a project or a series of special projects, and it has to become the operating philosophy of the organization. When that transformation occurs, then you can say that community policing has arrived.
Malekian outlines the mission of his office.
What we've tried to do over the last few years is to make it very clear that our mission is to help local law enforcement make the communities that they serve safer. And we do that through a variety of means.
Malekian's office pursues its mission by providing grants, offering technical assistance, and being a convener of best practices. And for Malekian, being a voice for law enforcement inside the Beltway. To do this effectively, Malekian has crafted a strategic vision that works to rebrand the office and reposition its programs.
One was to institutionalize or depoliticize the office. This office is not a federal jobs program. This office helps advance public safety. It helps advance the quality of life in neighborhoods, you know, across this country. And it should be evaluated in terms of what it does in that regard. So it really tried to convey that message. Secondly, was to ensure that the office was the voice for law enforcement inside the Beltway, certainly with inside the Justice Department. More than any other single agency, we deal directly with the local law enforcement agencies. Our funding grants go directly to them. They're not in the form of block grants. Our technical assistance projects go directly to those agencies. And not just the director, but the people in this office. We have a number of people with law enforcement backgrounds, a number of people with academic backgrounds who have direct connections. And so this business of being the voice. And thirdly and lastly was to bring this concept of evidence-based practice, which, and that's not unique to the COPS office, but this idea about what works and what works best and how do we make that part of law enforcement thinking. There's sort of a fourth strategic area that was not, certainly wasn't on my radar when I first came to Washington, but it has quickly become that, and that's helping law enforcement agencies deal with the realities of what the economy is doing. It's producing a profound change, and one that I think, like I said a minute ago, is not clearly defined yet. Its outcome is not clearly defined yet.
Without exception, the recent economic downturn has fundamentally changed the way policing is done in this country. The COPS office issued a report last fall highlighting that 12,000 police officers from across the country over the last 2 years have been laid off.
So it's enormous loss of capacity. The changes are going to occur, we believe, across sort of four fronts. One is a greater reliance on technology, which you alluded to earlier. Two is greater use of civilians, both as employees and as volunteers. There are a number of agencies that are doing some extraordinary things with civilian volunteers and with civilian employees. The third thing is an alternative response to non-emergency radio calls. And the last and probably most controversial is this regionalization and consolidation of departments across a number of fronts.
In light of these difficult times, Malekian continues to position his office as a resource for law enforcement agencies across the country. Along with many challenges, difficult times can offer opportunities to transform. According to Malekian, at some point, community policing has to cease to be a project or a series of projects. It has to become the operating philosophy of an organization. When that transformation occurs, then we can say that community policing has arrived. Over the last 6 months, we've also had an opportunity to speak with many public servants who are pursuing innovative approaches to achieving their mission and serving citizens. In this edition of Insights, we focus on how the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, relies on information and technology to carry out its mission to understand and predict changes in climate, weather, oceans, and coasts. With insights from Joe Klimovich, Chief Information Officer and Director of High Performance Computing and Communications at NOAA. Joe outlines the mission of his office.
Our office is responsible for essentially all the information and information technology resources. NOAA spends about $1.3 billion annually on its IT portfolio, and that's larger than all but four non-defense bureaus. So it's, and we're bigger than a lot of department IT budgets, so it's a pretty big portfolio. We have the standard CIO responsibilities of planning, reporting, oversight for all those investments, cybersecurity, information quality, privacy responsibilities. I'm supported by a CIO council composed of line office CIOs. And then we provide a whole host of enterprise-wide mission essential IT services such as email, web hosting, networking, security, response, and monitoring. And through our high-performance computing and communications program, we're striving to ensure that we've got the computing necessary to propel our science and our service missions, enterprise-wide supercomputing, to support both sides of that activity. A little bit different is that I'm also responsible for NOAA's Homeland Security Program, ensuring preparedness and response and mission continuity in event of a terrorist attack, disaster, or other emergency. One of the areas that we really spend a lot of time focusing on is a program called NOAA Link, and that's a partnership with our Acquisition and Grants Office, but it's an innovative strategic sourcing vehicle to provide economies of scale and enterprise-wide acquisition for our IT infrastructure and services. And then lastly is that I also serve as the Department of Commerce Senior Agency Official for Geospatial Information and also the senior executive responsible for the department's use of the radio frequency spectrum. So all that keeps me pretty busy.
Joe Klimovich fosters an enterprise view of technology as not simply supporting mission, but actually enabling mission.
Given NOAA's mission, I really look at it as you've got a lot of information coming in. You've got brilliant scientists adding value to that information, and then we send out that information to either the public or other agencies. And so information is key to NOAA's overall mission. None of it can happen without information technology. So one of the things we're trying to do is improve the visibility and decision-making by leveraging IT resources across NOAA and trying to position my office, CEO's office, in budget formulation and acquisition planning and really evaluating programs up front in terms of instead of responding to a crisis afterwards or some other issue. So up front in involvement in the budgeting and acquisition planning. Second thing I'd say is we're really trying to remove barriers to deliver a uniform, modern, agile, cost-effective set of services. It goes without saying if we can reduce the complexity, we can improve our security posture. That's one of the key things. I'm convinced that as we build more enterprise-wide services, it'll make it easier for us to secure our IT as well. And then lastly, I guess, looking at IT, is position IT as a mission enabler through the right services, common services, man and infrastructure that supports our diverse mission and really with a strong focus on improving customer service. Yes, we want to reduce our operating costs, but we also want to improve our service. We want to empower our employees to more effectively be able to execute their mission-critical activities with IT and information.
Stay tuned as we wrap up this edition of the Business of Government magazine. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. As we close this edition of the Business of Government magazine, I invite you to read our latest forum, unveiling the IBM Center's Governing in the Next 4 Years series. A presidential election year provides an opportunity to step back and consider major issues and management challenges facing government executives. The Center has devoted significant attention to this topic since its inception. Most recently, in 2008-2009, the Center launched its Presidential Transition Initiative, which provided how-to resources in helping government executives succeed. This year, we will build on that tradition with the inauguration of our Governing the Next 4 Years series. This forum introduces you to this initiative and highlights the key areas of interest we'll be exploring. Dan Chenick, Executive Director of the IBM Center, joins us now to discuss this initiative. Dan, what prompted the Center's focus in this area?
So, every time there's a presidential event, whether it is a change in administrations or a change in term, there are a set of leaders that come into Washington to run agencies and programs. And in the event of a change in administrations, they come in rather quickly. And in the current scenario, a second term, they come in over the course of months to about a year. And the Center has had a long tradition of timing the release of content that looks ahead to try to provide context for those leaders across several presidential transitions or presidential second terms over the last 15 years. And so the impetus for governing in the next 4 years was to take this event and sit back and think about what are the key issues that government executives, political leaders, SES managers, and program managers will be facing for the next several years. What are the key elements that not just are the, if you will, the usual suspect issues of financial management or technology or procurement, but thinking differently than what has been thought of or otherwise, what are some key questions that are going to be common to leaders as they're looking at the road ahead and how to achieve performance improvement in their time in Washington?
Dan, what are the key areas of interest explored in this forum?
Well, governing in the next 4 years really is a compendium of the thematic elements of the forum that I'll speak to in a moment, as well as an updating of some of the Center's reports from the prior 4 years, as well as a set of books that we wrote in 2008 to provide some context for the new administration coming in. The two books, Getting It Done and the Operator's Manual for the New Administration, both of which will be basically re-released. Getting It Done will be on the website and also in print form, and the Operator's Manual will be just on the website, where we are basically making current some of the advice that was true 4 years ago and is still true today. The other thing that we're going to be looking at with regard to the governing in the next 4 years series is basically a book-length type of examination of how does it